This is the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. With less than a week to go before Election Day 2020, I regret to inform you that our long national electoral nightmare will almost certainly not be over on Tuesday, November 3rd. And that's not just because we probably won't know the final results due to a historically high proportion of mail-in ballots that might take weeks or even months to tally. According to Stanford political scientist Morris P. Fiorina, my guest today, we are in an extended age of what he calls unstable majorities because neither the Republican nor the Democratic Party is popular enough to get and hold enduring legislative power. We're living through a historically rare period in which control of the White House and each House of Congress is regularly flipping back and forth between the two parties. Fiorina says the cause of such electoral chaos stems from the ways in which parties select candidates and political goals. Party activists tend to be much more ideological and unrepresentative, not simply of most Americans, but even of the other people in their own parties. So when they win elections, the parties push extreme agendas at odds with popular opinion, resulting in regular turnover the next time there's an election. In 2008, for instance, Barack Obama and the Democratic Party won a landslide before losing control of Congress 2 years later. Similarly, Donald Trump won the White House in 2016 and had a Republican Congress, the House and the Senate, only to lose the House in the midterms in 2018. Fiorina, who describes himself as a soft libertarian, expects Joe Biden to win next week and figures that it's likely that the Democrats will win a majority in the Senate while keeping the House. But he also expects electoral chaos to be back in the 2022 midterms and the 2024 presidential election because the underlying conditions that produce such unstable majorities haven't changed at all. Despite that message, I want to tell you I found this an oddly calming conversation filled with insights about history and politics and America's ability to muddle through to a better future even when we disagree sharply about politics. Please listen now to the Reason interview with Morris P. Fiorina. Morris Fiorina, thanks for talking to Reason.
Nice to be here again.
Let's start with what everybody wants to know, but can't, you know, we have to wait. What do you think is going to happen on November 3rd? Do you think Trump or Biden wins? Do you think the Democrats take the Senate and keep the House? What do you think is going to happen?
Well, the one everybody's most confident about is simply the Democrats keep the House and gain some seats, not a wave, but they'll probably gain 10 to 15 seats. I think it's also very likely that at this point that Biden will win the election. Probably the thing that's toughest to predict right now is the Senate, where there are just a lot of races that are right poised on knife's edge. And we could see anything from the Republicans holding the Senate to the Democrats having a 3 or 4 seat majority. I think probably the odds are that the Democrats get very close to basically a 50 or 51 seat in the Senate.
So if that happens, we've just in the 21st century, we've had something like 3 changes of leadership in the House, 4 changes in the Senate. If it goes to the Democrats again, that would be a 5th. The White House has gone back reliably up until this point from 2 terms of a Republican, 2 terms of a Democrat, and then 1 term of a Republican. First, you know, how rare is it that we've seen the kind of volatility in congressional majorities and White House, who holds the White House, going back and forth like that? Just how rare as a historical event is that?
Extremely rare. In our last, the last time we talked about my last book, The Unstable Majorities, I pointed out that this kind of chaotic electoral environment we hadn't seen since the late 19th century, a period they call it the period of no decision. And everything that's happened since we talked last time has only added to that. In 2018, the Democrats took the House back. In 2020, it seems very likely they'll take the presidency back, possibly the Senate as well. So this era of electoral chaos, flip-flopping majorities, I call it, continues as far as I can see.
Can you explain why are we in such a period of electoral chaos?
Well, I think, again, to think back on the last book, neither party has been able to govern in a way that constructs an enduring majority. That through most of our history, one party, well, we have all these metaphors out there. One party is the sun, the other party is the moon, et cetera. But the fact of the matter is, basically since the early Bill Clinton years, there's simply not been a stable majority on any of the institutions. And it reflects the fact that the Democrats lost their overall majority in party identification in the Reagan era. They were the party, the majority party from the 1930s to the early Reagan era. And now we have two very evenly matched parties, both of which are determined, and this is the second part of the argument, that we now have two parties that look like European parties, that they're very cohesive, very ideologically distinct. Historically, we've always had these big tents that it didn't really matter so much which party. Well, I don't want to push that too far, but it wasn't the end of the world for most people if the other party won. Whereas now the parties are so distinct that there is really this sense on the part of really strong Democrats and strong Republicans that the fate of the country rests on it. And meanwhile, each party wants to impose its particular platform, progressives on the Democratic side, the various conservatives on the Republican side. And the country isn't ready for that. We still have a big middle. And the middle sort of reacts in each election like, I didn't really vote for that in the last election. They swing back and you lose your marginal supporters and you lose control.
Can we talk about that metaphor of the sun and the moon? You know, this was, I guess, the idea. And boy, you know, this is really kind of deep cuts for political junkies. But people like Bob Michael, who was a major figure in the Republican Party in Congress in the 70s and 80s. But these were people who took it as a given that they would always be the minority party and that their job then was not really to change the weather, but kind of affect the tides a little bit. So that's how we were doing it, right? That where you had one party that clearly was dominant and another party which kind of nibbled around the edges.
Yes, that describes pretty well the period from the 50s into the 80s, certainly, to Newt Gingrich. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So what happens to, like, what will break this logjam? Because as you said, we have, you know, so we've got two parties that have sorted perfectly into, or at least somewhat coherently into a conservative party and a liberal party, and they fight to the death on every election. You know, they're each equally popular, or actually probably equally unpopular, right? Because neither of them actually can command, you know, even 50% of the population at any given time. What happens? How do we get out of this? And I guess maybe as a starting point, how did this end in the late 19th and early 20th century?
Well, the way it has ended is for one party to have a smashing victory and then to govern in a way that the country says, yeah, you're pretty good. We'll keep electing you. Now, we've had opportunities in recent years. George Bush, George H.W. Bush, then got into Iraq and sort of blew any chance he had. Obama, we had a great opportunity, I thought, but although he's a great guy, I don't think he was a terribly effective president, and certainly the country just completely shut the door in 2010 on that. Trump, I thought there was a possibility, however small, that Trump would come in and maybe behave differently from what we expected, perhaps push for a big infrastructure bill and bring a lot of moderate Democrats along. That hasn't worked out. So the way I've seen it is we simply had a bunch of missed opportunities until somebody, I'd be more optimistic if Biden were 20 years younger.
Why? What? You know, who are you to disparage him for his age? Why does that matter?
I don't think I'd be want to be president right now either. I said in the last book, I said that Biden would have beaten Trump. And I really felt that in the last right. time. But now I don't know, there are forces at work in the Democratic Party that Biden may not be able to control. And I think...
Can you name those forces? Who are the people or the forces in the Democratic Party? And just so I understand, you're essentially saying that Biden is kind of a centrist or a moderate or would He's certainly explicitly talked about governing for all Americans, whatever that means. But you're saying that within the Democratic Party, there's going to be a lot of, more extreme ideologues who want to go in a direction that will alienate the middle.
Yes, that's what I have said.
Okay.
And I think and it's clearly the case from the data that the activist base of the Democratic Party in many ways moved sharply left in recent years. that they're actually paralleling the Republicans in this respect. The people who have studied this say there are on both sides of the spectrum, basically something under 10% of people who are largely white, highly educated, extremely interested in politics, and very extreme in their views. And there's clearly, especially on issues like race, and this didn't just happen 2 years ago, this has been happening between the 2012 and 2016 election, where the activist base of the Democratic Party has moved sharply left. When they win, the scenario is they win, right. They take control of the Senate, they have the presidency, and then the demands are, now it is time to implement a progressive program. And I could easily see them, if they do so, getting beaten badly in 2022 in the same way they got beaten badly in 2010. Now, the other possibility, though, is that if they take control of the Senate and they win some more seats in the House, there will be a lot of people there who aren't fully on board with the Connor Lambs, for example, of the Democratic Party.
You explain who Connor Lamb is?
Okay, well, in the last election, where I grew up, Westmoreland County, Pennsylvania, he was been Democratic, of course, when I was growing up, but then went Republican, and remains Republican now. But in the district, where it was part of his district, he was a challenger, as I recall, a Marine, pro-gun, et cetera. And he won that election, and his district has been changed now, but I think he's going to win again. But there'll be those kinds of Democrats. Joe Manchin is the only Democratic like that remaining in the Senate. We could see a few more Democrats like that. We could see some more Democrats in the House who put a break on the progressive agenda. On the other hand, the funding now has gotten so national that these big funders who are very liberal on the Democratic side and very conservative on the Republican side can sort of impose an agenda, even on people whose basic constituencies and states don't necessarily support that agenda.
Would it be twisting your words too much to say that, in a way, we've been told this is the most important election of our lifetimes, and it may well be. I mean, because they're all like children, they're all annoying in their own specific way, right? But it doesn't matter so much what happens in this election because of this longer term trend towards polarization within the parties. To put more of a specific question, what are the odds, do you think, that the Democrats take control of Congress, both houses, they win the White House, and then they act as they did after the 2008 elections, and they go overboard and they get voted out again in 2 years?
Well, I think it's a real possibility. It may not be as probable because, A, they remember 2010. Mm-hmm. There's still enough around to do that. And B, I think in 2008, there really was a sense that the country had turned a corner of sorts and was ready for a new era. You remember all the comparisons of Obama with Franklin Roosevelt and mm-hmm. so forth. I think if Biden were to win and they take the Senate, it would be on the election results would be narrow, that no, these majorities were narrow, that they were built on places that weren't in accord with the more progressive elements of the party. And so I think there might be a tendency, or at least a break, on trying to do too much too fast. But who can predict?
Yeah, can you? Well, you're the political scientist, I guess. I realize you guys are better at analyzing what happened rather than explaining what's going to happen. But how do you think the events of the past 6-7 months affect all of this? Because the COVID lockdown is a bizarre. It's something that's really pretty much unprecedented, isn't it, in American political mm-hmm. history? Things like the George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter protests are, intense and meaningful, and we should talk about them. But those, we've seen something like that before. How do you think these two events, which are obviously intertwined, how are they going to filter into, your normal kind of analysis of what might happen?
Well, one thing they've done, especially the pandemic, is simply screw up all the forecasting models that we've developed over the years that predict presidential election results based largely on economic conditions, war, if there is one, on presidential approval. And most political scientists I knew were figuring that Trump was the odds-on favorite to win the election back in, say, January, mm-hmm. February. And then the economy tanked. Well, the pandemic tanked the economy. Mm-hmm. I don't have much faith in the models now because it's simply unprecedented that this was not your garden variety recession or anything. This was simply a meteor strike from the outer space. And so the pandemic, and I can understand Trump's frustration. This just sort of happened to him, but he was sitting pretty, basically, luckily, and then this happened. And I think it actually ties into the protests that the country was on such nerves, were such afraid that we've been locked down, especially the younger generation. And I'm not saying the Black Lives protests wouldn't have occurred with some other trigger, but certainly the timing that for so many people had a reason to go out and get together and do things, you know, that they hadn't been able to do for months, especially younger people who were, of course, the dominant force in these protests. I think all that tied in. I think this sort of outside event, the pandemic, really, really affected what's going to happen in this election.
Do you, it's clearly affecting it, but do you think, does it push in one ideological direction or another? Is there any way to kind of game or figure out where it's going to head?
I think what it did is made his personal flaws and strange characteristics even more prominent. Mm-hmm. That the fact that suddenly, as I said, he's frustrated that this event happens and upsets the apple cart just sort of aggravated all of his personal characteristics and all of the things a lot of people find unattractive about Donald Trump.
Do you think if he loses and the Republicans lose, is there a chance that they will actually become a kind of moon party? I can remember back even just in the early 2000s, people were talking a lot about a permanent Republican majority and that the Democrats were going to have to start to learn how to live as a kind of shadow party, really. Mm-hmm. It seems, if anything, that has flipped. Is that a plausible scenario?
No, I don't see a way out of the current situation that there are really serious problems. And so will a Biden administration be able to act on those problems in a way that 60% of the country thinks that they're doing well? I don't know. I mean, it's not as if there's only one problem. The activist base of the parties are so ideological now that there's going to be demands for Biden to act strongly on climate change. And there's going to be people unhappy if he doesn't embrace much of the Green New Deal. And there will be other parts that say, just pick your issue. Mm-hmm. He's not giving enough attention to race. He's not giving enough attention to this. He's not giving enough attention. He's doing this on foreign affairs. That it's just really not a good time to be a president.
And it's an opportunity. And he's waited so long. It's really kind of a Twilight Zone episode, right? Where you finally get to be president, but you're 800 years old and the country hates everything. Could you walk through your argument, which you've made in over the years, including in books like Culture War, about polarization? Explain why your contention, and I assume it still holds up, from survey data and whatnot, that, you know, large majorities of Americans are pretty centrist and we agree on a lot of things. But then the parties have been taken over by activists who are more and more extreme. How did that happen?
It's a real good question. And by the way, just recently, a nonpartisan research group released the results of a survey that surveyed 80,000 Americans. And the results were that on 150 specific policy proposals, majorities of Democrats and Republicans agreed. And that's the basic point, is that if you judge the two parties not on the basis of the people you see on CNN and the people on social media and the people in this sort of fever swamp of Washington, then you're simply seeing a country that's a lot more reasonable, full of reasonable people. Now, the polarization phenomenon is misunderstood in the following sense. It's not that the electorate as a whole is any more extreme than people used to be. It's just they've sorted out in a way that they didn't used to be. We referred to Manchin. There used to be pro-gun Democrats. There used to be pro-choice Republicans. And pick your issue, on one issue after another. If the other party one, they weren't going to come and take your gun away, or they weren't going to come and outlaw abortion, or pick any issue you want to. Whereas now the parties have gotten so well sorted. All of the liberals, all the pro-choice people were in one party, practically the pro-life people in the other party, guns, issue after issue. And so there is a sense in which if the other party wins, its platform is much farther from you if you're in the other party than it used to be. And that's what's given rise to a lot more of the gridlock, the sense that every election is sort of, it's a fight for survival, the country as we know it. And the idea is we need desorted parties. We need parties that simply don't line up on issue after issue, much of which don't make any logical sense anyway. They're political coalitions.
Could you explain that a little bit? How why is the Republican Party of being kind of anti-gay marriage, anti-abortion, pro tax cuts, and in love with the flag? Why isn't that a coherent philosophy?
Well, tell me what gay marriage has to do with tax cuts. Mm-hmm. And if you're a Democratic party, tell me what outlawing guns has to do with economic inequality. Just a lot of these things, they sum up. And you asked earlier, how did this come about? And that's the great unanswered question. It's really not clear. We can point to a few things, like when the Democrats lost the South, when Black people began to move north and driving the Democratic Party in the North in a more liberal direction, that increased tensions with the South, and eventually Republicans were able to take advantage of that. And at the same time, the Sun Belt was growing, as Kevin Phillips said, let's go hunting where the ducks are. And so we can look at a certain thing and say, okay, we know why race polarized the first, sorted the parties better. But then you look at an issue like, say, the environment. If somebody was going to tell you in 1960 that the environment is going to be a big issue 10, 12 years from now, which party is going to be the conservation party? You'd have said, well, the Republicans. It's the party of Teddy Roosevelt, the party of the Audubon Society, the Sierra Club, et cetera. Didn't work out that way. If somebody told you which party is going to be, abortion is going to be a big issue in 12 years, which party is going to be the pro-life party? You'd have said, well, the Republicans, or the Democrats, because they're Catholics and they're Baptists. And it didn't work out. So how these coalitions got formed, they did, and they were formed by political entrepreneurs. But there's not usually, I think, an ideological logic so much as a political logic beneath them.
A lot of people are talking about how among the various other ways that the country is being split is it's moving more and more into a kind of geographic schism of the Republicans are the party of rural America and small town America, and the Democrats are the party of big cities. Does that make sense, or is that a convincing argument?
No, I think it's definitely true. And it reflects the sorting that, again, we just came back from, we have a place in a ski resort on the Nevada side of the Sierra. And you go out there, you see Trump signs. I don't see any Trump signs around here at Stanford.
Yeah.
There are Trump signs out there. And there are signs on, Black Rifles Matter. There are bumper stickers like that. And these people, there's nothing about the Democratic Party that attracts those rural people. Just nothing. And by the same token, there's nothing about the Republican Party that around Stanford, around Palo Alto, is going to, and that's the function of the sorting that increases. And the sorting just takes geographic, if you're a gun lover, and the other part, the more serious thing, people don't realize this, but basically Democratic environmental policies threaten to destroy the economies of much of the country. If your economy is built on mining, logging, or ranching, farming, basically, farm price supports. But basically, most of it, because the Democratic Party has become the Green Party in the United States, it's driven away rural, large parts of the rural areas, unless they're based on ski resorts or or fly fishing, basically. So yeah, I think the urban-rural split has gotten really serious. It didn't used to be that way. That until 1994, when they got wiped out, there were pro-gun Democrats there, and there were pro-mining Democrats, et cetera. Somebody or a journalist called me a little while back and wanted to know about the permanent Republican advantage in the Senate. I said, when I started political science, people wrote articles like, why is the Senate more liberal than the House? And there were senators like Wayne Morris and Frank Church, and et cetera, all these Democrats in states like Montana and Wyoming, et cetera. But there's no place for people like that now. I mean, they were defending the rural interests, the mining interests, et cetera. No more.
Where do the suburbs come to play in this? Because, people keep talking about the city and the country, but a majority of people, certainly a plurality of Americans, live in suburbs. Is that the battleground, and are they proxies for either city or country?
No, increasingly it is, and they've been for a long time. Well, remember, when I was growing up, there were no suburbs. Basically, the United States was a country of big cities and little
towns.
And
you are 200 years old, or when were you growing up?
I was growing up in the 50s and 60s. And so the suburbs are a post-war phenomenon, and they really get moving. They don't become a political force so much. And then for a long time, they're, of course, the Sun Belt is suburban America. And they're more conservative. California used to be a red state, as long as California was sort of a post-war suburban state. And then more recently, they've become much more heterogeneous. They are no longer a Republican bastion in most areas. And so they are a battleground. And in a sense, they epitomize the problem with today's parties. If you're a suburban, you're a professional, two-income family living in a nice neighborhood in the suburb. If you want to have low taxes, you've got to ally yourself with the people who want to outlaw gay marriage. And your party choice is terrible. You know that you don't feel comfortable on either thing.
I guess at various points in American history, and if I misrepresent your views, please correct me. But in the late 19th and early 20th century, a kind of background ideology of progressivism, where the government was going to be doing more stuff than it had done historically, in a lot of different ways, and I guess mostly a kind of more aggressive foreign policy than America was used to, kind of became the norm. And that became a background ideology that both Republicans and Democrats could kind of channel and participate in. And that kind of ended the period of no decision. After the Cold War, even though the Democrats, you know, had a lot of control, there was a Cold War consensus about what domestic policy was kind of going to be like and what foreign policy certainly was going to be like. And so you could see people like Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy in 1960 arguing, you know, I mean, Kennedy won partly by painting Richard Nixon as soft on communism. But there was that background philosophy, that consensus. Do you see anything like that in the offing that might, if not, you know, it's not going to help one party or the other necessarily, but will stop the kind of waffling back and forth between one party having control for a few years and then giving it up to the other one?
No. In fact, you make a good point that, and this ties into what I said earlier about being a bad time to be president, that when Franklin Roosevelt won office, there was one thing he had to concentrate on: the economy. Getting people back to work, getting the economy prosperous again. And in the 1890s, I mean, we'd gone through a huge period of transition, but still basically the economy is the thing. And people decided Bryan's vision of the economy was better than, not Bryan's.
Yeah, McKinley.
Was better than Bryan. Whereas now a president comes in and you have the economy, still big deal as it always is. There's no foreign policy consensus. I mean, Trump really showed the weakness of the fragility of the internationalist consensus, that the elites have this sort of consensus about the United States has to be involved. And it's the basis of the Never Trumpers' sort of hatred for Trump, that he showed that it's not there among the population as a whole. And then you have all the social issues that used to be matters of local control, that abortion, gay marriage, transgender rights, guns, et cetera, were simply not on the federal agenda. And now you have sort of attempts to sort of impose federal policies on all of these issues as opposed to leaving them to the communities. And so just the issue space is so much more complicated. And the idea of how do you construct a majority in a three-dimensional issue space like that, that there's always some dimension on which the other party can beat you.
What do you have a politics of your own? Which way do you tip and things like that?
I'm a soft libertarian. I voted for the libertarian candidate in every election since 1980, including, I think I wrote in Rand Paul in the last election because Gary Johnson was such a crazy man.
Really? Wow. I thought when you said you're a soft libertarian, that would mean you still have Gary Johnson, swag that you're drinking coffee out of every morning.
By soft, I meant that you can't really, I can't go as far as Cato people. Mm-hmm. I don't think we can privatize the armed services and things like that. But my general principles run in those directions as much as possible, that the government should be the last resort, not the first.
Who will you be voting for in this election?
oh God, the Libertarian, I forget his name.
Joe Jorgensen. What does it say to you that according to, I think it was Morning Consult, only last time about 6% of voters voted for a third party. This time they're polling at 2%. So by the time of the election, it'll probably be closer to 1%. What does it say that, you know, to the unstable majorities thesis, or how does that factor into the idea that increasing numbers of people are voting either for the Republican or Democrat, even if the majorities don't hold up?
Well, what's interesting, well, you only have two choices, basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, people don't want to just throw the vote away. Actually, the 5 or 6% last time was sort of a big number, yeah, relatively speaking. The other figure that's interesting is when you ask people, are you a Republican, a Democrat, or an independent? When I was growing up in the Eisenhower era, 75% of the population said, I'm a Republican or a Democrat. Mm-hmm. The figure now is barely 60. Mm-hmm. And we can argue about, and I treat this in the book, about what independents are, but the fact of the matter is, a much larger chunk than before simply declines to say, I'm either one of those people. And I think it reflects the fact that a lot of people look at the Democratic Party and say, yeah, but I don't like this. And they look at the Republican Party and say, yeah, but I don't like that. And so they're sort of a little bit in between. It's not that they're necessarily principled centrists on everything. It's just they're cross-pressured. They like one party on one issue, another party on another issue. And, I think one of my favorite quotations, David Brooks years ago, said, somewhere out there, there's a younger, saner Ross Perot. And I think that sense that a person who's self-funded, basically every time a Bloomberg or a Jim Webb or who's the Starbucks
Howard
guy,
Schultz.
Every time I get a little excited. But I mean, I want somebody to crash the system.
Right.
I want somebody to come in and just do well enough, a 30-some% of the vote, that it really shows the fragility of the present alignments. Mm. And other politicians that say, okay, we gotta construct new alignments.
Do those alignments typically come from within the parties, or is it something that gets forced on them by either a third party that somehow swells up in power, or, you know, a kind of extreme global events that just make, to just shred the status quo?
I think both. We have examples where you basically, the Democrats pull away the Populist Party to their electoral destruction in the 1890s. Mm-hmm. You basically look at Newt Gingrich does the same thing essentially to Perot, looks at the Perot voters and say, these are the things we got to appeal to these people on. And then you have the outside events and you have the forces building up to society, like race, that the parties simply don't address. Yeah, neither one of them can address it, like before the Civil War and even in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And so I think it just, the instability generates instability for a lot of different reasons.
You have mentioned Newt Gingrich several times. He seems to be, oddly, even though he is still haunting the political scene, you know, on like Newsmax, and he's orbiting further and further out in the galaxy, but he's still around. He is clearly one of the major change agents of, you know, the past 30 or 40 years of American politics. What was his particular contribution? And in the end, do you think, was it beneficial or negative?
Possibly negative, but I'm not sure on that. The contribution was, earlier referred to Bob Michael, and who said, we'll never be a majority, so we just have to try to make whatever the Democrats do a little better. And Gingrich comes in and absolutely rejects that. And he launches a movement nationally to sort of recruit people who like that. Now he does, and basically he succeeds in 94, they lose the South. The Democrats lose the South for the first time. And that's the end of this New Deal Democratic majority in Congress. And so in a way, I mean, you have to give Gingrich credit for bringing the Republican Party back up to competitive status. But the result was these, as I look back now, these two sorted parties and increasingly getting more and more sorted, which is not, I mean, not healthy for a two-party system. Mm-hmm. If you want to have 3 or 4, 5 parties like that, okay, they form coalitions. They have to get together. They have to negotiate. But if you only have two, and each one of them has maybe 35 to 40% of the public, then when they win and they say, okay, this is what we're going to do, then there's a majority that's against you, basically. And so the system can't work in this way. We have real problems. Unfortunately, government is the only way of addressing some of these problems, as I say, as a libertarian, yeah. And the party system is incapable of addressing them at the present time.
So there's a good chance we're going to be having this conversation again in 2022 and 2024 and 2020. I'm doing counting by twos now, 2026, yeah, sure. 2028.
I expect we will.
What is the likelihood that, that if Joe Biden wins, he actually, I mean, his rhetoric is, especially over the past couple of weeks, has been pretty strikingly ecumenical. Do you think he will try to govern as a, you know, as he says, a president for all Americans, even people who voted against him? Or is that just campaign rhetoric?
No, I think he will try. And I think given his history, his political history, and the way he worked in the Senate, and even in the Obama administration, the way he tried to reach across Republicans, I think that's probably what he really wants to do. Now, the question is, will it work? And would the Republicans let it work? Hmm. I mean, basically, whatever initial inclinations Obama might have had quickly evaporated when it was clear Republicans weren't going to go along with anything he tried to do. So I'm not sure Biden alone could be that important.
Could you comment on, I'm thinking now of just how odd it was. In the 2016 season, and I know I participated in this as a kind of dumb, you know, journalist who covers politics, the Republicans had so many people that were all so great, it seemed. You know, they had a deep bench, a young bench, a multi-ethnic bench, several women were in the mix and everything, and they got wiped out almost immediately. And now it seemed it flipped where the Democrats had this amazing rainbow coalition of candidates, and they end up coughing up this, 78-year-old hairball, who it goes back to the time when, Delaware still had forced busing programs. You know, is there any way to predict where we're going to be in 2 or 4 years?
If you know, let me know. I don't. And again, as you said earlier, we're not good at predicting. That anybody who would have sort of sat down in 2000 and said, here's what's going to happen in the next 20 years, I think anybody would say, no, it's too unbelievable. You can't, you got to sort of calm that down.
I know some people, friends of mine who are kind of Republican, but they're not the never Trump Republicans, because they were never, they were more libertarian than that and not quite so hawkish, but they're also not Trump fans at all because they don't like populism and things like that. They are holding open the possibility that the Republicans get beaten so bad that they really have to do a kind of postmortem and come out, inevitably. Of course, these people want a more libertarian Republican Party. And regardless of the specifics, could you talk about what happens to parties where they get squeezed out so much that they actually reconstitute themselves as a different ideological being? Does that happen often? And if so, what might we look for if that's going to be happening in either party in the near future?
It happens, but it takes longer than one election. That I think if the Republicans lose this election, there will probably be a huge internal conflict, and I doubt that it'll be resolved in time for the next election. Mm-hmm. If you think back to the Democrats, they get sort of the run they had. They get wiped out. Well, 68, they come apart. They get totally wiped out in 72. Jimmy Carter's an accidental president. They get wiped out again in 80. They get wiped out again in 84. And 88, finally, 1992, they say, okay, this isn't working.
Right.
Then Bill Clinton sort of pulls them back to the Senate.
And he wins with, 43% of the vote or
yes,
something like that?
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, so it can take a long time. Mm-hmm. You may have to age out the entire activist and leadership echelons of a party before they turn around. Or think about the Republicans through the 30s, just simply not willing to come to grips with the New Deal till the 40s. So, I mean, it could take a long time. And I think probably it's more likely that here's the unlikely scenario, but what if the Democrats lose again? Mm-hmm. And I think at that point, they come apart. At that point, they have more or less a civil war. It's the progressives say you lost because you didn't embrace progressive policies. Sensible people say that's insane. And you basically have some kind of reconstituting of a more centrist party. So I think it's the most likely party to do it would be the Democrats, but only in the unlikely event that they lose the election a second time. What would it say about a party if you lose to Donald Trump twice in a row?
Yeah, that's almost too much to even consider. It would be delicious just as a thought experiment. Are you optimistic? Or, well, actually, before we get to questions of optimism or pessimism, what does it say to you, or does it matter that, you know, the budget, the federal budget for fiscal 2020, you know, which ended a couple months ago, was coming in at about $4.8 trillion. That was a record high. It was, you know, the most money the U.S. government would have ever spent. Instead, because of COVID and other things, the bill comes in at like around $7 trillion. Both candidates now are talking about spending massive amounts of money that's pretty much going to be laid on top of that new baseline. Does that factor in at all, or is that the new consensus that we're kind of dealing with parties who are willing to spend vast amounts of money? And, you know, it's just that it's, you know, one party wants to do it a little bit less and on this, and some, you know, the other party wants to do a little bit more on something else.
I mean, maybe that's the new consensus until interest rates go up. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, neither one of them seems much concerned about the budget at the present time. Mm-hmm.
So I guess as a final question, you know, is this a time to be optimistic about America, which seems to be in very short supply for any number of reasons, or is this a time that pessimism is actually warranted? And if so, why?
In between that, I mean, I don't think we're on the verge of civil war. I think that the fever swamps of our newsrooms and and social media are just not accurate, not reflective of the mood out there in general. But at the same time, pessimism is warranted. There are big problems. No one seems to have a good idea of how to get a handle on them. I think a lot of people just wish for something better, but don't really see it out there on the part of either party. And so it's, you know, I think it's hard to be optimistic, but at the same time, I'm not overly pessimistic. You know, if you go back and look at the 60s, and again, I was a graduate student in the 60s.
So you were part of the problem.
Yes, I was.
At least according to Spiro Agnew, right?
But if you look at the destruction, and you look at the loss of lives, and the violence, and all the same sorts of things, the election's going to be canceled, et cetera, et cetera. And we somehow muddled through it. And so I think we will probably as a country do it again, although it won't be pretty and it won't be quick.
Well, on that cheery note, we're going to leave it there. We've been talking with Morris P. Fiorina of Stanford and the Hoover Institution. His most recent book is Unstable Majorities. Mo Fiorina, thanks for talking to Reason.
You're very welcome.
This has been the Reason Podcast. I am Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe at Apple, Google, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, at Google, at Stitcher, at SoundCloud, at Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, or you can go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there and check out the Soho Forum Debates and the Reason Roundtable, our two other podcasts. Thanks for listening.